DW Africa Link.
Is anyone listening to Africa when it comes to climate change? World leaders are meeting in Baku, Azerbaijan, for the annual UN Climate Change Conference. COP29, which is the 29th edition of the Conference of the Parties, is expected to encourage solidarity for a green world. Many African countries are pushing for climate financing from wealthier, more polluting countries to help combat the climate crisis. Promises have been made before, but so far, many in the global south feel world leaders are yet to walk the talk. So how relevant is the conference still for Africa? Can wealthier countries be pushed to deliver on their promises? And if that does not happen, can Africa tackle its climate issues alone? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Abuja, Nairobi, Harare. Africa Link's correspondents bring African stories to you.
Africa aims to set a new climate finance goal, exceeding the $100 billion previously promised by developed nations. However, experts warn that without debt relief, this effort may be ineffective. Africa faces severe climate vulnerability. Of the 20 countries most at risk from climate change, 17 are in Africa. So, increased climate financing is needed to help the continent build resilience against climate change and ensure sustainable development. That's why climate change conferences are important. But how have such summits helped so far? We hit the streets of some of Africa's capitals to find out from citizens, starting with Dan Kaburu in Nairobi, Kenya.
The current COP at happening in Baku doesn't matter much, because when you look at the previous COPs that have been taking place, a lot of pledges are with nothing much to show for it. Okay, in as much as Africa and Kenya, of course, we are affected by climate crisis, it doesn't make a lot of sense when the global emitters meet and always have to exchange or move the goalpost.
In Lilongwe, Malawi, Angela Firi and Wesi Banda weigh in.
We need tangible results whenever they come back. So I still believe that through those recommendations that come out, through those suggestions that come out, there is more that Malawi can benefit from such meetings, you know. There is little that we can show for that this is a result of that meeting, you know.
COP meetings often lead to commitments from developed nations to provide climate financing, which Malawi, as a vulnerable country, can benefit from funding to support climate adaptation and mitigation projects. We have seen our ministers, we have seen those people, those players in the climate sector, saying that Malawi is supposed to benefit from this. And we are certain that Malawi has been benefiting from climate financing opportunities. The other thing is about policy alignment. Participation of Malawi in COP meetings helps our country to align its policies with the global climate goals, ensuring compliance with international agreements like the Paris Accord.
And also in Accra, Ghana, let's hear from Safiya Mohamed Ikilil, student at the University of Media, Arts and Communications.
So if they do the meetings all the time and these same people are those who had these big companies and they vouch for industrialization, but at the end, they also sit that climate change. If they want to make things okay, then that means industrialization has to slow down or has to stop. And I don't think at the point we've gotten now in this world, industrialization is going to stop.
Those were fellow Africans from Malawi, Ghana, and Kenya commenting on the relevance of climate change summits. Big thanks to our correspondents Isaac Kaleji, Andrew Wasike, and Miriam Kaliza. Now, with those points fresh in our minds, we're now going to link up with some very interesting people taking part in the COP.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
Let's dig into this issue with journalist Zainab Wandati, sustainability and climate editor at Nation Media Group in Kenya. I also have Sena Aluko, chair of the AFSA Climate and Agroecology Working Group and executive director of Young Volunteers for the Environment in Togo. Now, for those of you that do not know what AFSA is, AFSA is short for the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. Hello to both of you. Welcome to the Africa Link podcast. Zainab, let me start with you. For almost 30 years, global leaders have been discussing the climate. You've been covering this for a while. Has anything significant been achieved so far?
I did ask the African group particularly this exact question during the climate talks in Bonn earlier in the year, before the COP process. Is usually the Bonn meeting, which now sets the agenda for the COP. And I asked them why they are at it for 30 years and barely anything to show for it. And they said, while it looks that way, there is a little bit of progress that's made, even though it's low progress. And one key example was the outcome of the Sharm el Sheikh when the loss and damage fund was finally set up, which was a win for Africa and other countries in the global south that had been advocating for this city for the 30 years of the COP process. So that you could say that is what, that was one of the greatest achievements that maybe you could say that has come out of the COP process. Even though the kitty was empty in Sharm el Sheikh, the fact that the document had that accepted that language and even accepted to set up that kitty in the first place, you might say is a win. However, with COP29, the African group is not very happy, because they say, the chairman actually says, very likely Africa might walk away with nothing.
Right. And that has been a bit the challenge. Let me come to you, Sena, and let me just announce to our listeners that both of you are actually on the ground where COP29 is happening. So you are there seeing everything live in Khaled. Sena, what do you think is being achieved this time at COP29?
This should be like something like my 20th COP. I've been around for the past 20 years. I've seen how the negotiations started on most of the thematics like Red Plus, carbon market, the Paris Agreement. I've seen them all through. So I think a lot has been happening beyond what my colleague Zainab just said about the loss and damage fund. We saw the adaptation fund as well, where we forced countries who were trying to do business on forests or carbon market to set some percentage aside. From 2%, now we're talking about 6 to even 10% of all the money generated by the carbon market that go to communities. We've seen amazing in Dubai, for the first time in history, the UN, a UN body saying we need to move away from fossil fuels and double solar or renewable energy and triple energy efficiency. Those are very big news. And if you see in terms of participation, this Baku COP, this COP29, is the second largest registered COP after the Dubai one. More than 60,000 people registered for this COP. Of course, not all of them are around, but it shows there's a great, great interest in the COPs. But the good thing that I'm happy about, for which we should be going again and again to the COP up to COP100, COP200, is at the COP, multilateralism wins. At the COP, humanity is at the center. Because if we fail to uphold the values behind the COP, behind the spirit of the UN Convention on Climate Change, then the whole discussion will be happening where? At G20, at G7, where we, people from the ground, frontline communities, don't have a voice at all.
Sena, I'm going to come to you again with this, because you touched on some of the world powers, the very wealthy countries that, you know, research suggests that they are the ones polluting the world even more with, you know, fossil fuel, oil, all these emissions, you know, that is affecting the world. So let me just mention something interesting. In 2024, a significant increase in new oil and gas exploration is poised to release nearly 12 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, despite their climate commitments, like you suggested, the world's wealthiest nations, including the US and the UK, are at the forefront of this surge in fossil fuel expansion, right? That's according to new data obtained by the Guardian media outlet. So, are countries serious at all in tackling climate change, Sena?
So yes, you are not wrong with how big emitters are trying to play the bad game, trying to transfer the responsibility of addressing the mitigation of carbon emissions to developing, sometimes even least developed countries. The thing is, they don't want to commit, they don't want to pay their fair share, and they try to delay all the time the negotiations. What we have witnessed again and again is that they are trying now to renegotiate the very basic principles that are behind the UN conventions. The convention is led upon key universal values, the polluter pays convention principle, the historical capacity, historical responsibility principle, common but differentiated responsibility principle, etc., etc. So those principles should be at the heart of the negotiations. But now you can see they're moving away from the common and common but differentiated responsibility. They want China, they want Brazil, India, and South Africa to pay almost the same fair share. And that's even worse. Now they are opening a big window for the private sector to come in as a contributor, whereas the private sector is not a party to the UN conventions, and private sector is not even one of the negotiators here. As Africa Group, and the Africa Group put a figure on the table, the $1.3 trillion that we are asking for annually, from 2025 to 2030. This is where we are now, and unfortunately, the latest election in the U.S., I can't say is going to jeopardize the whole thing, but definitely it's going to send some strong signal, depending on what the U.S. government will decide to do with the Paris Agreement, the U.N. Convention, and other U.N. conventions, will definitely have a long impact on the future of the negotiations.
I don't know if you know, but there are over 1,700 fossil fuel lobbyists at this COP. 1,700. And the president of Azerbaijan himself, in his open address, in his when he addressed the world leaders, he said fossil fuels are a gift from God. And so this fact, you might say, outrage amongst various groups attending this COP, particularly the groups in the Global South, because they felt if that's what the president feels himself, how can you trust the presidency to guide this conversation away from fossil fuels, which is an outcome that the Global South wants?
And I think that's definitely a fair statement, because talking about Azerbaijan, the country's economy heavily relies on oil and gas production, which is obviously, as you say, it's at odds with the goals of reducing global carbon emissions. So this is why it keeps begging the question, are countries even being serious about this? Well, this current COP29, the key focus, or one of the key focuses, is climate financing, right? COP29 focuses on financing climate action for developing countries. Africa, despite contributing the least to global greenhouse gas emissions, suffers disproportionately from climate change impacts. Let me come to you, Zainab. What really does Africa hope to achieve from this COP29, considering that a lot of the promises about, you know, damage or loss, a lot of the promises about loss and damage, or, you know, climate financing has not really come through?
Well, whether or not it's ever gonna happen, at this point we say never, because sometimes when you least expect things is when they happen. One of the key things that Africa wanted, of course, was the new collective quantified goal. This new collective quantified goal is in line with the Paris Agreement. In 2015, the Paris Agreement allowed for a new goal to be set. So this new goal, Africa is setting it at 1.3 trillion, but it's still not enough, because sub-Saharan Africa itself needs 45 trillion. That's the climate debt that the region is owed. But they've decided, no, we'll just do 1.3 trillion. And they've haggled a lot about this over the last few days, and they're developing the global north says you're being unreasonable. So this was one of the key asks for Africa. And I have to applaud the continent this time around, their strategy, everyone. I think they all called themselves to a meeting and told themselves, listen, we can't be reading from different screens. Every time you talk to anyone, you say $1.3 trillion. So that messaging has stuck. The continent also wanted some adaptation funding goals met. Anything about finance hasn't really gone very well because Africa, besides just the number, they also wanted timeline. What is the time frame within which this money will be made available? Who is going to contribute to this financing? How much will each person be contributing? They've not agreed on that. The gender discussion was also key to Africa. And in fact, with the gender discussion, Kenya's lead negotiator says the text itself is 100% in brackets. Everything is in brackets. And now they were even trying to introduce more brackets within those brackets. And some of the key things they were haggling over, the gender team wanted to change strategy away from everyone else in the negotiation.
At the end of the day, the challenge is no one can force any country to actually walk the talk, right? There's a lot of talk, but the walking part is still challenging. If any country says, I'm going to give, you know, an African country or African countries $100 million per year to deal with climate change and they don't do it, how do you make them accountable, all right? I mean, there can be so many excuses given, and that somehow has been the challenge. Let me come to you, Senna, to get your thoughts on this. What are the key barriers African nations face in accessing existing climate finance mechanisms? Clearly, that's not been working well. That's why they are even pushing for more and pushing for actually walking the talk this time.
I don't think we are begging for money. We are not begging for charity or for solidarity here. It's at the core of the convention that in the very first article of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, that developed countries should support developing countries or countries that are affected by the climate crisis with finance, technology, and other means of implementation to allow them to survive and even build a prosperous economy. When we come here and put in numbers on the table, it means that this is what we want. And those numbers are even more than what the UN, if you read the Standing Committee of Finance, which is one of the official bodies under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change here, the figure they put, it's almost more than that, because if you put all the NDCs together, how much all the NDCs, the National Determined Contribution, need to be implemented by 2030, you go far more than 2 trillion a year if you add to it all other aspects. Government are talking about 1.3 trillion, but activist group who calculate how much the global north owes to the global south, they talk about 5 trillion a year.
Isn't the challenge, Senna, that no matter what amount of money we want to agree on now, the challenge remains that how can you force these wealthier nations, the nations that are polluting the environment even more, how can you force them to pay up? That's the challenge, isn't it?
Yes, you're absolutely right. There's no need about forcing someone here. Once you sign, you commit yourself as a country, and you need to comply with what you have signed. So there are a series of vehicles that we're going to use. That's why here we are more and more talking about biannual transparency report, the BTR. So beyond the annual communication by countries, biannual communication by countries, we are now talking about biannual transparency report by each country. So we want to know who paid what we saw in the first phase, the $100 billion that was suggested, proposed in Copenhagen. There were even money paid to build roads, to build hotels that were counted as climate finance. So you are right, it's a challenging topic, but this time around, we have put our own figure on the table. We know how all this work. Like lately, we got this report from OECD that developed country has in total have sent more than the 100 billions that were promised in Copenhagen. What was shocking for most of developing countries, because we didn't see where the 100 billion plus US dollar, where did they go to?
Zainab, let me come to you. The truth is, to be honest, this all sounds like deja vu. I mean, what makes this any difference? And I'm asking this in connection with the point that you started raising earlier about U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, right? He has been consistently skeptical of climate change. He has referred to it as a hoax. During his first term, he even withdrew the United States from the Paris Agreement and rolled back various environmental regulations. He's coming again. Where are we headed?
Well, Argentina also pulled out of this COP. Their president is equally a climate denier like Donald Trump, and he's also a close ally of Donald Trump. So on day three, I believe, he recalled all 80 of his delegation that were here. And when he was campaigning last year, he is on record saying climate change is a hoax. And he's also cut down some environmental funding. So there are more and more leaders around the world coming up who are deniers. Now, the thing about the COP process is that even though the agreements are legally binding, the weak link is the political will. Because if you talk to the negotiators, one thing they'll tell you is, when the world leaders, the presidents, the prime ministers, and all the heads of state and government come here, they make such big promises and they stand, take the podium during the World Leaders Summit. And they say, my country commits to this, my country commits to this, my country commits to this. However, when it's time for the rubber to meet the road during the actual negotiation in those negotiation rooms, their negotiators do the exact opposite. They do something completely different. And this is because the decisions taken here don't just have an environmental implication. They also have a political implication and therefore an economic implication. So a country whose economy is built on fossil fuels will definitely not be interested in any discussion that faces out fossil fuels.
Right. And that's the challenge, Sena, as I come to you to try to wrap things up. That's the challenge. Many African countries are dependent on these wealthy countries actually walking their talk and committing the money that they promised to commit. If that is not happening, and as we've said earlier, also African countries, you know, face huge challenges if climate change is not addressed. So the question I want to put to you to wrap this up is, can African countries afford to address climate concerns on their own if the world leaders are not committing to what they are promising?
Yes, we can survive without the rest of the world. Why we are here? Because we believe in the power of solidarity, diversity, humanity. We think it's important to fight all together. We think we need to give something back to Pachamama, our Mother Earth. That's why we're here. Otherwise, we can all sit back and relax and do the best we can do. If you think right now, you go to most of the countries. If I take the case of Togo, where I'm coming from, if I take the 100% of all the money that the government got, like money from outside, about 80% of the money of grant come from civil society, diaspora, you know, citizen groups, and just 20% come from those things you know you call like World Bank, EU, etc. But the rest they give is just loans. Our country can do without. Now the world is talking about transitioning away from fossil fuels. So what do they need for that transition? They need our minerals. They need our strategic minerals that we have in DR Congo, in Tanzania, etc. So we have something to offer to the world. We wish we do this all together because we were in this together on behalf of the UN Declaration on Human Rights, 1948. On behalf of the Paris Agreement, these countries must pay their fair share. And like the Americans say, there's no business on a dead planet. If Africa is weak, if Africa is not there, with who they're going to do their business?
Right. The flip side of it is that if the world leaders, wealthier nations, are not committing to their promises, and you say that Africa has what it takes to you know, save itself basically from the impact of climate change. That is also the tricky one, isn't it? Because it's all about also how much money they are prepared to commit to it. Is there the political will for many African countries to put the millions and the billions of dollars that are needed to tackle it? And that's all going to be the challenge, isn't it?
If these people, I'm talking about the world powers, the elite, the agro industry, the farming industry, livestock industry, all those people, the multinational companies, if they can free our continent just for one day, please leave our continent. We can do everything on our own. And second, our own leaders, if we can just reduce by half corruption, evasion of illicit money. You know, if you can reduce just the illicit flow of money leaving Africa every day to Europe, to US, to those, how do you call it, paradise countries, if you can just do just by half, we have enough money. If we can be serious in our own country, working in our citizens, there's nobody to be put on the margin. Our politicians don't like those who are abroad. But if you look clearly, our diaspora is sending a huge amount of money to our countries. Yes, if Africa government get serious, do things on our own, work it with our diaspora, our civil society, our farmers, promote our young people, our innovations, we can survive without anybody on this planet. Africa can be. But anyway, my dear George, this is what's going to happen very soon anyway. Whether they like it or not, Africa is going to be back and stronger very soon. It's just a matter of time. And as you can see on the continent, some countries, some groups are already taking the lead. So, yes, we wish they pay their fair share. I hope that they are going to pay. But if they don't, we will decide how to do things. And this is not the first time, like Zainab said, Argentina pull out. Papua New Guinea decided not to come at all. In 2016, all African negotiators left the UN premises. So it's possible that tomorrow Africa decide not to come to the show at all. So we have things that we have in our basket. We just don't want to use them now. So we are here. We are watching, hoping that the power of the good will win over the few who are not trying to play the good game.
Right, right. On that Pan-African optimism high note, we will wrap this up. This is a conversation that can go on forever, but really appreciate your time. Journalist Zainab Wandati, Sustainability and Climate Editor at Nation Media Group in Kenya. Also, Sena Aluko, Chair of the AFSA Climate and Agroecology Working Group and Executive Director of Young Volunteers for the Environment in Togo. Thank you very much, guys, for your time. That's it from this edition of Africa Link. Join the conversation on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. Click follow so you don't miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Kai Nebe. And I am Eddie Micah Jr.
DW. Made for Minds.